So today we're going to go through a cluster of cases. We're going to focus first on several that relate to wills. Then we're going to move into several relating to estate administration issues. Then we'll touch on a number of trust cases. And finally, we have just a smattering of miscellaneous cases that don't necessarily fit in one of those categories, but certainly pertain to this area of practice. So we're going to work our way through those this morning. We're going to start with a case out of the Eastland Court of Appeals. And you'll see on this slide and the slides following, I kind of have a summary of the topic of the case, and then, of course, the style of the case and the court. But most importantly, I want to show you that on each of these slides, I have the page number where the case is located in Professor Byer's materials. So if you want to refer to his materials, for a better summary and also for the style of the case, I would refer those page numbers to you. So again, starting with our first case, it's the matter of the estate of Etheridge. This case and the next one pertain to the interpretation of particular terms or terminology as we might use it in a will and the importance that can have on the effect of the will. In this case, the testatrix had prepared her own will, and in her will, she provided that all of her personal effects were to go to her nephew-in-law. That was the only dispositive language. It did not provide a residuary beneficiary or what happened to any other asset. It just stated that personal effects were to go to this nephew-in-law. Of course, his position was that that bequest was intended to pertain to all personal property, just not those assets which we would normally term or define as personal effects. And the court disagreed. The court found, Court of Appeals again, Eastland Court of Appeals, found that the term personal effects is a narrow subset of the larger definition of personal property. And it pertains or refers specifically to those assets that are of a very personal nature, specifically clothing, jewelry, even eyeglasses or luggage, I think were defined by the court as fitting within that category, but obviously of a very personal nature. So the gift of personal effects was very limited, did not include accounts, stocks, other mineral interests or royalties. And so those other assets passed by intestacy to her heirs at law. Our next case also pertains to the definition of personal property or personal effects, but specifically use the terminology personal property. In this case, it's the estate of Hunt out of the Houston First Court of Appeals. And in this case, a will made a gift of all, you see the language here, of all the testator's remaining household and personal property. And the inclusion of that term household along with the personal property in that phrase is what kind of created some confusion in this case. And of course, the beneficiaries of that wanted to be very broad in that definition of personal property. The other beneficiaries wanted to say, oh no, that was intended to mean personal effects, since it kind of clumped that together with household and personal property. The court disagreed and said, nope, this is not an ambiguous term. We know what personal property means. It means both tangible and intangible personal property. It's basically everything not real property. So in this case, that definition of personal property did include accounts, did include stocks. The fact that it was included in a phrase of household and personal property did not change the definition of those words. And so it was given a much broader definition than would be the term personal effects. Our next case is another Houston First District Court of Appeals case. This is Brewer versus Fountain. And in this case, I mean, this is one that I see in my practice on occasion. I imagine many of you will see these types of issues come along. In this case, the testator gave particular individuals a right of first refusal to buy property from the estate. And specifically, it provided that those individuals who had the right of first refusal were to this terminology is here on this slide, were to pay a sales price equal to the appraised value of the real property. So equal to the appraised value. And the court interpreted that to mean the county's appraised value as of the year of the testator's death. But very critically in this case, the will provided that those individuals with a right of first refusal had the right to buy any or all of the property. They weren't obligated to buy the entire property. They could pick and choose what they wanted to buy. Here we had a homestead or a house with attached acreage. And in this case, the individuals who had that right chose to buy the house and part of the acreage, but not all. So they paid or attempted to pay the appraised value of the house and then a pro rata share of the acreage that was attached to the house. Well, naturally, they picked the primo land that was attached to the house. So they picked the part that had the lake and the access road, but they didn't want the pasture. And so they were kind of handpicking out or cutting out the prime part of that land and left, of course, the less valuable land, which was made far less valuable as a result of having cut out that more appealable portion. The trial court found that that was unfair and ordered that the property chosen by the individuals who had that right be reappraised to find the specific value of that particular property. And when the appraisal came back, it provided a value of 350% of the value based purely on a pro rata determination based on the county's appraisal record.